Good morning, everyone. So this morning we're finishing up the Big Issues series, and we've got a big question. We've got the question, why God allows suffering? And I want to dive straight into this question by just thinking about the problem that's often sort of thought through. So this is the question, why does God allow suffering? And the kind of problem that's often described, we can try to draw out by using these four different statements. So here they are, the four statements. Number one, God exists. Number two, God is all powerful. Number three, God is all good. And fourthly, that evil exists. And it's argued rationally that you can accept any three of those four statements, and it kind of adds up, it's fine, but you would have to reject the fourth one. So if we take an example, if we accept that God is existing, we accept as well the reality of suffering, so we'll accept statement number four. We also would have to accept that God is all good. It would be therefore argued we'd have to reject statement number three, because if God is good and there's evil, then surely he would want to stop it. It therefore means he's just not all-powerful. He can't stop it. So there we go. And another example, if we think about another example here, is that, again, we'll accept that God exists. Again, we'll accept that evil exists. But this time we'll accept, we can't deny that God is all-powerful. And so it would therefore, again, be argued that you'd have to reject statement number two, that God is all good, because if he's all-powerful and evil exists, he can stop it. It must be that he just doesn't want to. He chooses not to. So we would reject that God is all good. So this is the kind of the problem that is posed often with this particular question of why suffering. And atheism, the belief in no God, would reject statement number one. And so they don't have that same kind of issue. Pantheism, which is the belief that God is everything is God, sort of, it's an overarching, blurs that distinction then between good and bad, and they'd probably reject statement number two, that God is all good, because if God is everything, then it's kind of a bit blurrier. And religions such as Hinduism and Buddhism and New Age movements, they have this slightly more blurred distinction. We as Christians, however, we affirm all four. We believe we have a God that is all good, all powerful, and he exists, and that will exist too. We don't deny that there is evil and suffering in the world. In his book, The God Delusion, Professor Richard Dawkins proclaims that everyone is atheist about almost all the gods that have ever been believed in, but just some of us go one God further. That's his sort of challenge. And Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist that many will probably be familiar with. And so he kind of has a very naturalistic way of explaining the world, that everything can be explained through these sort of biological evolutionary processes, and would deny God, is a very strong atheist. And in a famous quote that I'll read out, he states that in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties that we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. These are really very strong words, aren't they? You can probably pick it up from the quote there, but by rejecting God, it says there that there is no purpose, there's no evil, there's no good. And what Richard Dawkins isn't saying here, that I wanted to sort of highlight, that he's not saying atheists or those that are not Christian are any less moral, that they don't hold really important values and principles. And I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that some of the people that most inspire me are not necessarily Christian. You know, there are a lot of my family that are Hindu. I have friends and colleagues that I think would describe themselves as atheist, and they provide me with inspiring examples of how to live a life, trying to serve others and trying to make a difference in the world. And that's not what this quote, and that's not what atheism is saying. But what it does say, which is probably quite clear from the quote, is that when you get rid of God, there is no objective sort of definition or determination of what is good and bad. And what the atheist view would argue is that it's either determined individually or through a kind of society. Individually, it would be that I determine that what I'm doing is, and then what I'm doing here is bad. Or that as a society, we determine that something is legal or illegal. I wanted to just frame this initially to highlight that whatever worldview we have, whether you're Christian or atheist or have another faith or no faith, there are always kind of tricky things to try to make sense of. There's always going to be challenging questions. But maybe, as we've hopefully highlighted here, is this question that we have, this is a Christian problem, because our God is a God we believe is all-powerful, all-good, and we don't deny that there is evil in the world. So this is very much a question that we have to try to contend with. And we're going to watch a film clip, very short clip, that is hopefully going to set it up a little bit more this morning. But I guess we don't have much time. And I want to just say from the beginning that there's no easy answer, I suppose. And this is a question that's been debated for a very, very long time. But if we just watch this film clip, it's a film clip from a theologian who has sort of written a lot and thought a lot about the question of suffering. And he introduces in this film clip an idea, a concept that he believes can help us to make sense of this problem. And it's not for that reason that I'm showing it. It might be part of it, we can try to make sense of it, but the reason I'm showing it is hopefully that it will just help us bring to life the problem of suffering. So if we are able to watch that, we'll then pick it back up again after. For me, that video just brings to the forefront the examples of suffering. That's why I think that video is helpful. But that one presenter there was giving examples of so many different ways in which we suffer. And some of those might be ones that we kind of connect a bit more with, that we may have in our own lives. And others may be things that we don't think about so much, but nonetheless are just so tragic and so tough for people to be experiencing. This morning then, is going to be a tough question for that reason, that we are here and experience pain ourselves. And so I think it's just holding that in mind as we try to unpack what the Bible has to say, some themes that the Bible helps us to think about when we try to respond to this question of suffering, but not to deny the fact that it's a really tough thing, and made all the more difficult and more significant when we're in that situation. So firstly then, thinking about one of the first themes, this is a question of, it's probably a fairly over-familiar kind of concept, but it's the idea of love and free will. So this idea that for love to exist, it has to be freely given. We were reminded just a few weeks ago, of the creation story. And in that story, we heard of all that God had created. And there on the screen, we see it's not on the screen. Apologies. I'll read it out. God saw in, it said in verse 31, he saw all that he had made, and it was very good. So we have a God that created everything from nothing, a powerful God, but also a God that had made everything very good. There was no suffering. Later in the verse, or in the passage, God is making man and woman in his image. So there's this idea that we see the world around us as being a beautiful, beautiful place, but God loved us so much that he imprinted on us his image. And so we're made with this capacity for love. In this verse that is on the screen, God commands man, you are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For when you eat from it, you will certainly die. God provides us with this instruction not to eat from the tree. He warns us of the consequence. He asks us to obey him. But he also, in that one quote, gives us that freedom. We can choose to eat from any of those trees. So for love to exist, there is both this freedom and this consequence of our choice. To kind of illustrate this, a good example is marriage. For me, I think about my wife Kirsty, and I think if she was forced to marry, if I had hypnotized her so that she had no choice but she married me, we'd be together and she'd be with me only because she had no choice. On the surface, you can kind of imagine, I could make everything exactly the same. There could be, we could be doing all the same things. I was thinking even yesterday, I didn't get to watch Match of the Day. But if Kirsty was hypnotized, I could have made her be the one, come on, Ben, let's watch Match of the Day. You can kind of imagine an even better scenario. But the reality is, which is simple, but I think really hard to get, is this idea that actually it would change the meaning. You know, her just being forced to do what I want her to do would be lovely, maybe, but it wouldn't be love. That's the kind of the reality of it, that for love to exist, it has to be freely given. I was also thinking about our vows. In our vows when we got married almost 4 years ago, I always thought the vow, the famous vow, would be I do. But the famous vow is I will. It's a freely given will to love each other. C.S. Lewis says that free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. And so with free will comes the possibility for disobedience, that we don't choose to do what is good and what is asked of us. And so as we read those few weeks ago in the Genesis account, there was the fall of man, where Adam and Eve directly disobeyed that warning that we read earlier, that if you eat from it, you will die, that dying and suffering comes into the world. And so our human nature and our creation that we live in was changed as a result of making that choice. And that verse 5 in chapter 3 of Genesis, the serpent is planting in Adam and Eve's mind the idea that they could become like God. It says, "For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." And in Romans 7, it says, "The mind governed by the flesh is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law, nor can it do so." So we became, in that early account, we became focused on ourselves rather than on God. And this is so key to the picture, is that we didn't want to obey, we didn't want to submit to God. We wanted to become our own masters and forge for ourselves our own happiness. I was thinking about this idea, God giving us goodness. The world, Garden of Eden was beautiful. It was good, very, very good. And yet what we wanted was to selfishly, greedily become our own master, reject God. I think of the prodigal son. I think of us just totally rejecting God, knowing that he has asked us not to do that. We also, and it's stated in that passage, that verse there in Romans, that God's love, that freeing love that he has for us, also goes in hand with his law. In Isaiah 1, God is stating to Israel, the nation of Israel, through Isaiah, he's kind of detailing the tragedy and the horror that they're experiencing. They have rebelled, they have just caused wickedness and conflict, and he's detailing all this really brutal, horrible, horrible suffering. And he cries out through Isaiah, he says, "Why should you be beaten anymore? Why do you persist in rebellion? Your whole head is injured. Your whole heart is afflicted." God's given us that free will. That's what love is. But he's also warned us. He's telling us and he's pleading for us to come back to him, to stop that rebellion. I was kind of reminded of just being a child. I was thinking about this idea of a parent or someone that's looking after us, being someone that lovingly allows us to develop independently. That's what is wonderful as you're growing up, is you're developing your independence. You know you are loved and you are trusted. But alongside that, you couldn't just be left to your own devices. You also get taught, you also learn what's good and what's bad. You learn to sort of follow the instructions to navigate through life and growing up. And I think it's that tension that just helps us think about that verse. Why should you be beaten anymore? God is pleading with us. He's not forcing us to not do those things, but he desperately wants us to not be suffering. So we believe we are in a fallen world. This is the idea then that we can be negatively now affected by sin. And we don't believe in karma. But we believe that instead what happens is we can experience suffering as a result of our own sin, as a result of others freely sinning against us, or just as being in a world now that is fallen, that is broken, where suffering exists. And on the surface, I think I am probably more likely, at least on the surface, to blame others when I'm suffering. It's like when you're rushing around at home, I'm hoping I'm not alone in this, and you suddenly whack your toe on something, the most intense pain, right? But it's ridiculous how suddenly you aggressively start shouting at the furniture, "For goodness sake, you stupid chair," as if the chair is really to blame and it's going to sort of make it all better by apologising. You know, it is a silly example, but for me, there is something about this idea that we struggle to, or I at least struggle to accept how I, at times, am culpable, and that we as humanity have rebelled, and we rebel, that brings along suffering. The Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "If only there were people, evil people, somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it was necessary only to separate them from us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being." For me, this is slightly more the bit where it gets a little bit more emotional, because whilst I've talked there about our culpability, I guess I've also highlighted how much suffering can be as a result of other people freely hurting others. And this kind of reality of the world that we live in being a broken world where there is seemingly randomly just horrible illness and health problems or just natural disasters. In his book, The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis highlights how pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. It's in that pain and vulnerability that I think God speaks really very clearly and loudly to us. Or maybe that we also sort of keenly listen out for God. You have to turn on the news to see how much we gravitate to tragic stories. It's constantly tragic stories, and we all tune in and follow and listen. And so this image of the megaphone is maybe quite helpful to think about us as in our pain, possibly being on a bit of a platform. You know, when we're suffering, the world is watching, and the question might be, kind of, what am I saying to the world in the midst of my pain? And again, this is where I think it just feels really, really tough, really, really difficult. And I wondered whether part of the question, why does God allow suffering, is where are you, God? Where are you in that moment when we're really struggling, when we're really in pain? And so it's really key to think about this idea that God works through suffering. We read earlier in that Genesis account that God did not create it. He created the world and he created us, and it was very good. But it doesn't mean that because he didn't create it, he can't work through it. I was thinking about the story of Joseph. I know we don't have time to go through it, but just to think really very quickly a little bit about the story of Joseph, which I hope is familiar. But there's the key sort of initial headline, which is that Joseph was sold by his older brothers, his jealous older brothers, as a slave. He was sold into slavery. So he would have experienced rejection, and he would experience suffering as a result. But then he gets used. He's sold to Pharaoh, and he's made quite an important figure. But later, again in the account, he is wrongly accused and sent to prison. So more and more suffering through Joseph's story. But he again ends up sort of, he's got this gift, this God-given gift of dream interpretation, and he becomes in charge of the whole of Egypt. And it's a beautiful ending to the story in that he is reunited with his family, he forgives his brothers, and there's a good ending there. But what's clear is that Joseph knew anguish and suffering. And as we think about this idea, reading in the actual passage of Joseph, the story of Joseph, we read over and over again these words that the Lord was with Joseph. It says in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, so he prospered. Verse 21, the Lord was with him, he showed him kindness. And in verse 23, again, it says, the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success. Joseph had many twists and turns, and we all have these moments of feeling really, really overwhelmed with pain and suffering, and we can maybe have other times where we recognize that things are going well. God is with us. That is who we have as our God. And I think there can be this view sometimes, maybe at times, maybe more regularly, where we think of God as this God up in the sky who just doesn't care. He's not involved in our lives. He's watching us from above as we struggle on through. And that's just not the God that we know. As Christians, we have a God who is a personal God that we know and that loves and that cares for us. It's the famous, probably the most famous words in the Bible, John 3:16, proclaim, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life." So Jesus suffered on earth. We know the nativity story. We know that the circumstances in which Jesus was born, he walked amongst us on this earth and suffered. He was rejected and despised by us humans. He was referred to as a man of sorrows, a man of suffering, familiar with pain. So we know our God isn't this distant God that doesn't know and doesn't care. He is a God that experienced pain, experienced death for me and for you. There's a story told of a school that's collapsed, and it killed all the teachers and it killed almost all of the children. And I'm just going to read out this story. A little boy, maimed badly, was rescued from the rubble and rushed to hospital. For hours, a team of doctors and nurses fought to save his life while his mother waited anxiously outside the operating theatre. 7 hours of painstaking surgery, the little boy died. Instead of leaving it to the nurse to tell the mother, the surgeon went himself. As he broke the dreadful news, the mother became hysterical in her grief and attacked the surgeon, pummeling his chest with her fists. But instead of pushing her away, the doctor just held her to himself tightly until the woman's crying stopped and she rested cradled in his arms. And then, in the heavy silence, the surgeon began to weep. Tears streamed down his face and grief racked his body, for he had come to the hospital himself the moment he heard that his one and only son had been killed in the same school. We may feel that same anger that mother felt, that anger towards God. I somehow think God's big enough to take that, big enough and loving enough to understand that. We have a Father who welcomes us with embracing arms. And I guess this is the really key part for me as I've been preparing and reflecting on this question. It is such a tough question. It's just the fact that we have a God who loves us that much, who undeniably has shown how much we mean to him. And in Jesus, most importantly, not just through death, but in his resurrection, has paid the price for us. In Romans 8, it states that now we have a hope, that our sufferings now are not worth comparing with glory that is to be revealed to us. I feel like there's lots of different themes here that the Bible can help us to think about this question. And we have only just kind of touched on a few, But just to kind of reflect back over some of those themes, this first idea is a key part, which is God's love requires free will. That love without being freely given is just not love. And for me, this is probably something, as I said at the beginning, it's probably a concept, an idea that I've always talked about, I've always thought about whenever I've come to this question, but I really do feel that it's so hard to totally try to imagine a world where there is no choice, actually. And then we have, as a result of that freedom, we have the reality of suffering, that the fall of man came, where we were free to make that wrong choice, and subsequently we've constantly been free to sin, to bring suffering into our world. But God, most importantly, works through that suffering. We have a God who can bring good from the suffering. Though he didn't create it, though he didn't intend for it, he can work through it. And finally, this idea that God is with us. And to me, this is the really key bit, is that we hear in the Bible, we read through so many of the stories in the Bible of different people, different accounts where God is with them. That this is most powerfully shown in Jesus, that through Jesus coming to this earth, he showed us that he knows suffering, that he's with us in our suffering, and that we have a hope in a future and an eternal hope. I just wanted to finish by asking who God is to you. When you think of this question, why God allows suffering, I wondered whether some of what we're, the Bible is helping us to think about is the character of God. And there are different experiences that we all have growing up and getting to the point that we're at right now, where we may have a particular idea of God. And I suppose the encouragement would be to think about who we're thinking of when we talk about who God is. Because there will be people here, as I said, that will be really struggling with this question because of personal suffering, either their own or the suffering of others. And it can bring up really a lot of emotion. I know this question is a slightly academic question as well as being an emotional question, but I think the emotional side, the feeling of anger and fear and sadness that comes when we accept that reality, when we experience that suffering, just makes it so much trickier. And so if you could, I would encourage you to speak to someone this morning. If there is suffering, if there is pain, if there is stuff from the past that is rejection, if there is stuff currently that you're dealing with, that people here will be more than happy to talk with you a bit more about this or to pray with you through it. And also this idea that we have a God who's paid the price, that we don't have to feel any guilt or shame for any of the pain or suffering that we feel we may have caused or that we may have caused. And so if there is a feeling of guilt or shame that you have as a kind of awareness of what suffering you may have caused to yourself or to others, then again, just to be encouraged to collar someone, ask for prayer, or to chat a bit more a bit about this this question of suffering, because we have a God who is good and powerful and loves us. Amen.